Now, for contemplation of the mind. Let the discerning man guard the mind, so difficult to detect and extremely subtle, seizing whatever it desires. A guarded mind brings happiness. Dhammapada 36. The meditation subject called contemplation of the mind is a profound practice that every meditator needs to learn. During Buddha's time, there was an old man who entered into Buddha's sasana to become a monk. After ordination, his teacher taught him to learn by heart all of the 227 rules that a monk must follow. He tried very hard but faced many difficulties due to old age. After he learned all 227 rules, another teacher taught him Abhidhamma, which is even more complicated. 89 types of consciousness, 52 mental factors, and 28 kinds of matter. In the beginning, he put forth energy to try to learn all this, but soon realized that owing to his old age, it was just too much. He could not handle it, and eventually he became very depressed and decided to disrobe. Having read his mind, Buddha came to him and said, "I know it's very difficult for you as an old person to learn all these things, but can you learn just one thing?" The old man was so happy and replied, "Only one? Of course I can." Then the Buddha told him, "Contemplate your mind." If you feel like the old man considering the Dhamma to be too complicated to learn, then learn just this one thing, contemplation of mind. Buddha first taught this practice in the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind as mind? Here a bhikkhu understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust. He understands mind unaffected by lust as mind unaffected by lust. He understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. He understands mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion, and mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. He understands contracted mind as contracted mind, and distracted mind as distracted mind. He understands concentrated mind as concentrated mind, and unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind. These instructions given by the Buddha are so brief and so concise that they are almost beyond our comprehension. Such brief instructions were intended for especially intelligent listeners, such as the Kuru people, to whom Buddha taught this discourse, and may cause the rest of us to wonder how one is to carry them out. Let's take one of the states of mind and explore the meaning. What did Buddha intend when he said, mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate? All of us have ill will or hate. When hate arises in us, instead of understanding that hate is a state of mind, or a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate, at that moment we grasp at the hate as my hate. I am angry. Anger is I. Anger is mine. Anger is myself. Carried away by our hate because of our grasping of and identification with the hate, we can't understand that it is a fleeting state of mind. We don't see a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate. Buddha said, "Sabbe sankhara anicca, all formations are impermanent, including the mind and the body and all the mental factors such as aversion, lust, delusion, everything except nibbana. So anger, ill will, and hate are also impermanent, subject to change, subject to destruction. However, because of our grasping at the hate as I, mine, myself, we can't see the change. Our grasping interrupts our perceiving these phenomena as they really are. Instead, we perceive these states as interrupting us, and when we regard our hate as self, we indeed do freeze or pause the hate. Its nature of arising and passing away is interfered with or interrupted. As a result, that hate seems lasting and real, owing to our holding on to and engaging with it. When we see hate as permanent and as a self, the ill will never leaves the bottom of the heart. We keep our ill will by identifying with it as I, as mine, and as a result, we end up suffering from aversion, owing to our identification with and grasping at the heat. When we try to hold a fireball, the fireball burns us. How can we prevent ourselves from being burned? Throw it away, right? Let go of it. Everybody knows the answer, but when it comes to a real situation, when anger really arises in us, most people choose to hold on rather than throw it away. Because of our grasping at the anger, I'm angry, my anger, we are burned repeatedly, and the anger remains dormant in the heart. We may be burnt 100 times by the fire of hate, and still we do not learn from the bitter lesson. This is because we lack the skillful means to handle it. How do we throw the fireball away in order not to be burnt? The remedy is to arouse mindfulness and mentally note the mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate, repeatedly, maybe 100 times. Learn this. Key in on this way of noting on your internal computer. Mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate. Hate is not I, not mine, nor myself. When one understands a mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, one knows that hate is just a mental state. It's just a mental factor arising at this moment. If one doesn't identify with or grasp onto it as my hate or as I, myself, the hate will pass away very fast because all formations are subject to change. The hate is not going to last long. This is the nature of all formations. If the nature of the arising and falling of hate is there, but owing to our firm grasping we do not want to let go of it, how can hate disappear? Some people grasp the hate or bear the grudge for 20 years, 30 years, or even into the next lifetime. That hate is dormant in the mental stream life after life. In the next life, when you see the enemy again, your memory will flash back and the anger will arise again. There is no end to it, is there? As a Dhamma practitioner, it is very unwise to carry the burden of grudge around, because by doing so, you make yourself unhappy first. When hate arises, be mindful that hate has arisen, and remember, mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate. Repeated mindfulness makes the wisdom understand that hate is just a mental factor, that all mental factors are impermanent and non-self. Having seen and known this, you can let go of the grasping. Once you let go of that clinging, you are immediately freed from the burning sensation caused by anger. In the same way, he understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust. Sometimes the mind is overwhelmed, beset by lust for desirable objects. If mindfulness does not recognize that the mind is affected by lust, identity view will spring up and grasp the lust as I, mine, or myself. In order to satiate the lust, one has to act either verbally or physically to satisfy the intense craving the lust has caused. Thus, unskillful action is performed. Once unskillful action is performed, it leaves behind karmic energy, and when this karmic energy ripens, the result follows one like a shadow that never departs. Therefore, you must know how to contemplate the mind to protect yourself from performing unskillful actions and from harming others. Mind is the forerunner. Both body and speech listen to the mind. Without volition, the body can't act. In order to eradicate all defilements of the mind, we must contemplate the mind. If you know how to contemplate just this one thing, it's enough for your practice. In fact, by learning just this one thing, the old man attained arahantship. However, this is one of the most difficult things to learn because the mind changes so quickly. In the round of rebirths, although we cast off our body life after life, the mental stream continues to roam, all the while mistakenly identifying our mind and all our mental factors as I with identity view and mine with craving. This grasping of mind has been very deeply rooted in our mental stream, so it's not easy to give up. It is easier to contemplate the body than it is to contemplate the mind. The Buddha continued, saying, he understands mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion, and mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. Sometimes, because of delusion, we perform unskillful actions of speech and mind. When this happens, instead of blaming ourselves, we must see mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion. Delusion is also a mental factor, not a self. Next, he understands contracted mind as contracted mind. Contracted mind refers to sloth or torpor. When this arises, the mind becomes drowsy. I think only a few of you see drowsiness as merely a mental state. When sloth and torpor arise, most of us will immediately identify sloth and torpor as I and say, I'm drowsy. I'm drowsy. Try to look at drowsiness directly when it arises, like looking at a stranger. This is a very effective way to do away with your drowsiness. But you must begin at the very moment you feel drowsy, not after it becomes heavy. Just be aware of contracted mind. Don't struggle to get rid of it at first. Instead, look at it face to face, and the mind will immediately become clear. This way of looking at the contracted state of mind also frees the mind from identity view. You just know at this moment, mind affected by drowsiness as mind affected by drowsiness. Drowsiness is not mine, not I, not myself. Then, he understands distracted mind as distracted mind. Having overcome the contracted mind, one is harassed by another hindrance, a distracted mind. When the mind begins to be distracted by thinking about the past or future, be mindful, be aware of the distraction. Rather than indulging the wandering mind, know it as a mental state of restlessness, and that the distracted mind is not I, not mine, not myself. Contemplate distracted mind as distracted mind. If this does not work, take a deep breath, pause until you feel the need to breathe out. Then breathe out slowly. Visualize yourself blowing out all the distractions. Repeat the process several times. He understands concentrated mind as concentrated mind. You may have been practicing concentration for some period of time, and you may have developed good concentration. However, I would like to remind you that developing concentration is for seeing things as they really are, not for grasping the concentrated mind itself. Some of you feel very delighted when concentration is very good and immediately grasp onto concentration as mine. People say, my concentration is very good, or they identify concentration with I. This happens automatically because we habitually identify everything as I, mine, or myself. Without self-identifying, we almost don't know how to live in this world. It is this self-cherishing attitude that keeps life going. So when concentration is well developed, understand concentrated mind as concentrated mind. With this understanding, you will neither be conceited, thinking your concentration is better than anyone else, nor be in competition with any other. If you are, when concentration falls away, you will probably be disappointed. When you understand concentrated mind as concentrated mind, you feel free from grasping onto the concentration as self. Concentration goes up and down and is not permanent. You've experienced this for yourself. Next, he understands unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind. Sometimes after the best sitting, concentration suddenly drops to the worst, and the mind becomes unconcentrated. If you can contemplate unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind, you will not be disappointed. If concentration were self, you could have a very good concentration at every sitting. It is precisely because concentration is not self that it fluctuates. When the conditions are there, concentration develops. When the conditions are not there, concentration cannot develop. Just see concentrated mind and unconcentrated mind as conditioned phenomena and know that what is conditioned is beyond our control. At times during meditation, your mind will be beset by remorse when the sluggish mind forgets to contemplate a mind affected by remorse as a mind affected by remorse. Instead, you keep on thinking about the wrong deeds you have performed. Indulging in thought makes the thought become real, and you end up feeling sorry. This is because you do not contemplate a mind affected by remorse as a mind affected by remorse. You identify, you grasp, you cling to this remorse as I, mine, or myself, and suffer accordingly. Though you're sitting there very quietly, Your mind is agitated and restless, so it's very important to learn how to contemplate each distinct state of mind. Some people have been meditating 10 years or 20 years, and yet they still do not know how to contemplate their mind. What a loss! If you think you have been practicing for 10 or 20 years, and yet the ego is still big, ask yourself, what is wrong with my practice? It is possible that it's because you fail to see mind as mind. Instead of identifying every mind state, happiness, concentration, restlessness, sorrow, hate, lust, etc., as I, mine, or myself. Buddha gave only a few states of mind in this sutta. Mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust, and mind unaffected by lust as mind unaffected by lust, mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. Mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion, and mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. Contracted mind as contracted mind, and distracted mind as distracted mind. Concentrated mind as concentrated mind, and unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind. You can extend your knowledge and contemplate other states of mind. Mind affected by jealousy as mind affected by jealousy, loving mind as loving mind, happy mind as happy mind. Sometimes while radiating metta, you feel very good, happy, and peaceful. This is the benefit of practicing metta meditation. However, it will be good if you can also contemplate happy mind as happy mind, so as to not identify the happiness as I, mine, or myself. Metta is also a mental factor. After explaining the different states of mind, Buddha continued to explain the way of insight. He said, in this way, he abides contemplating mind as mind internally, or he abides contemplating mind as mind externally. Nowadays, contemplation of mind externally is largely ignored, even though it's very important. What do we mean by contemplating the mind externally? Let's say somebody shouts at you or harasses you. You become offended and are skillful enough to contemplate your state of mind as mind affected by hate. However, if by contemplating internally you cannot let go of the suffering caused by other people, then move on to contemplate the external mind, your enemy's angry state of mind, as the mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, repeatedly until you lose the perception of self. Another purpose for contemplating externally is to remove attachment to our beloved ones. We take their mental states as objects of our contemplation externally. Attachment causes suffering. Seeing others as the manifestation of different states of mind only, not as persons, we lessen our strong attachment to them. Buddha further said, or else he abides contemplating in mind its arising factors, or he abides contemplating in mind its vanishing factors, or he abides contemplating in mind both its arising and vanishing factors. This refers to contemplation of dependent origination and insight into rising and falling. Having seen mind as mind, one further investigates the cause of the arising mind state. For example, having contemplated a mind affected by lust as a mind affected by lust, you investigate what causes lust to arise. It could be due to external impingement of sense objects to sense bases, such as when a charming girl comes into the range of sight of a man causes the latent tendency of lust to arise. The visible object of a charming girl is the cause. The arising of the lustful mind is the effect. Or abusive words uttered by another contacts the ear base and triggers the latent tendency of hate to arise. The abusive words are the cause. The arising of a hateful mind is the effect. The formula of dependent origination says, when this exists, that comes to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. Discerning dependent origination is an important insight knowledge, which answers the questions, who am I? Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? By contemplating cause and effect, the causal relationship becomes evident and the non-self nature of mind unfolds. When the cause vanishes, for example, when the charming girl fades from sight, then the effect, the lustful mind, will also cease. Or when the abusive words stop impinging the ear base, the hateful mind comes to cessation. However, this is just momentary cessation. as the latent tendencies of lust and hate become dormant. At this point, one also sees the arising and passing away of conditional phenomena. When a person does not see that a mind affected by lust is also impermanent and subject to destruction, the lustful mind will persist to the extent that one is enslaved by that sensual urge. The mind and body become tormented and burned by the fire of lust. Unable to resist that sensual urge, one gives in to unskillful action to satiate that lust. The fulfillment of the lust, although it satisfies the mind, makes the mind even more lustful. We must contemplate the impermanence of any unskillful mental state in order to sever its proliferation. When perception of impermanence is not given attention, the phenomena, in this case the lustful mind, is concealed by continuity. But when one contemplates impermanence, the continuity of the unskillful mental state is interrupted. Without experiencing the knowledge of arising and passing away, the realization of nibbana is not possible. This knowledge is the gate to liberation. When there is arising of any mental state, the characteristic of its generation is arising. The characteristic of its change is passing away. The contemplation of arising and passing away is knowledge. This is seeing the arising and passing away of mind from moment to moment. The Buddha continued by saying, "Or else mindfulness that there is mind is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and repeated mindfulness." This statement is very important. Again, "Or else mindfulness that there is mind is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and repeated mindfulness." When mindfulness is repeatedly established in knowing the mind, then the knowledge arises. There is mind only. Mind is neither I nor myself. One's mindfulness is so keen that there is mind, is simply established to the extent necessary for bare knowledge. Repeated mindfulness is needed here. One moment of mindfulness is not enough. Although sometimes you may be mindful of your mind as mind affected by lust, you still cling to lust as my lust, owing to weak mindfulness. Similarly, you may mentally note mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate when your mind is beset by hate. However, you still cling to hate as my hate. This is superficial mindfulness. Mindfulness has the characteristic of penetrating the object rather than floating away. When the mindfulness sinks into the object, mind, it gives rise to insight. With insight, one knows that whatever the state of mind, a lustful mind, a hateful mind, a deluded mind, etc., it is not a person, not I, not myself. This is what the Buddha meant when he said, "Or else mindfulness that there is mind is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and repeated mindfulness." And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. The world usually refers to the five aggregates of clinging. Having seen mind as mind, not a being, having investigated mind's arising and vanishing factors, having understood the impermanence of mind from moment to moment, one doesn't cling to one's own mind or to other people's minds with identity view and craving. Without clinging, one is not agitated. Thus, he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides, contemplating mind as mind. Perception of non-self, thus accrued through contemplation of the mind, is crucial for those who want to develop the bodhisattva path, awakening others as well as oneself. When the mind is rid of a self-cherishing attitude, the power to assist others develops to the fullest, and working for the benefit and welfare of others is possible. Now to the attitude of the mind. While contemplating the mind, keep the mind in the middle. Watch different mental states in a dispassionate way without getting involved. Let everything come and go without reacting to it. See whatever arises as foreign, as empty, or devoid of self. We can take pain as an example to contemplate the mind. While watching the physical pain that arises during sitting, instead of looking at the pain, look at the mind. What is your reaction to the pain? If there is an aversion, then contemplate aversion as mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate. See this state of mind again and again until you reach the point where you can clearly see that hate does not belong to me, it is not myself. The pain is your great teacher if you know how to contemplate skillfully. Don't suffer the pain for nothing. Without mindfulness of the mind, some may develop aversion to the physical pain and yet be unaware of the hateful mind. If, when looking at the pain, you remain equanimous, then contemplate an equanimous mind as equanimous mind. See whatever reaction you have toward pain and contemplate that state of mind as it really is, without getting involved. When you practice in this way, the pain will not bother you anymore. And while you are observing the mind's reaction toward pain, regard yourself as a third party observing other people's pain. Don't think the pain is yours. If you think the pain is yours, then you can't bear it. Don't get caught in identity view. With intensive meditation, different emotions such as anger, greed, joy, fear, remorse, and depression may spring up. Recognize them. Let them be what they are, merely impersonal mental events. Look upon all mental states, all emotions, dispassionately. See whatever arises as conditional, as a third party, as empty or devoid of self. In this way, one frees oneself from entanglement. From a psychological point of view, this way of looking at things allows one to step back. One separates emotionally and is thereby relieved of the worry and fear that, in truth, does not belong to one. In reality, physical and mental phenomena momentarily arise, perform a function, and naturally fall away. This is the nature of all emotions, arising and passing away repeatedly. You will succeed if you just look at them without reacting, bearing the perception of impermanence in mind. So this is the way to contemplate the mind. If you are proficient in this skill, life becomes happy. Finally, sharing of merits. Through this generosity, may my spiritual teachers of great virtue, my mother, my father, and relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the merits of my sharing. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my generosity and through this act of sharing, may all desires, attachments, and all harmful states of the mind quickly cease. Until I realize nibbana, in every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. The Dhamma is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. May my departed relatives receive and rejoice in this sharing of merits. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.